Dr. James Hansen is the world's most prominent climate scientist. He was one of the first scientists to bring global warming to the attention of the world when he delivered congressional testimony on climate change back in the 1980s. Since then, he has become increasingly radical. Dr. Hansen is adjunct professor at Columbia University's Earth Institute. He has been director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York since 1981. He's written a book published a couple of years back called Storms of My Grandchildren, subtitled The Truth About the Coming Climate Catastrophe and Our Last Chance to Save Humanity. He has called for mass civil resistance to, and indeed was arrested for his participation in, a protest against coal mining. He's in New Zealand lecturing on climate change, a moral, political and legal issue, he says. And Dr. James Hansen is with me now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure. A couple of figures. Let's get them on the table. First of all, currently the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is 388 parts per million.
Yeah, actually 390. That was last year's number.
Okay. Reducing it to 350 parts per million might mean, you say, we can halt climate change.
Yes. In fact, we've now quantified very well what we would need to do to restore the planet's energy balance. Because the world, scientists around the world have distributed more than 3,000 floats around the world's ocean with instruments on them that yo-yo down to a depth of 2 kilometers and yo-yo back up. And they measure the temperature in the ocean very accurately. And what we observe is that the ocean is getting warmer, and we can quantify how much the energy imbalance of the planet is, how much more energy is coming in than is going out. And if we want the climate to be stable, we have to restore the planet's energy balance.
Let me just ask you about the warming ocean. Has the ocean warmed as much as you thought it would have?
Yeah, it's very consistent with what we expected, given that change in atmospheric carbon dioxide.
Because some people say, no, it hasn't. It hasn't warmed nearly as much as would have been expected based on climate sensitivities exhibited by the climate models tracked by the IPCC.
No, you do have to take account of the fact that humans not only have increased carbon dioxide and methane, but also atmospheric aerosols. That's the small particles, the air pollution that you can see. And that air pollution reflects sunlight. So that reduces the heating of the Earth. But the dominant effect is the increasing CO2.
Now, until relatively recently, you and the IPCC were as one that reducing the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere down to 450 ppm, or keeping it at 450 ppm, is a safe level. 350 was something you changed your mind to, wasn't it?
Yes. I think most people thought that warming of a couple of degrees might be something we could live with.
And this is the attitude taken by most governments, and indeed the IPCC still, is it not?
Yes, I'm afraid it is. But when we look at the history of the Earth, we see that the last time it was 2 degrees warmer was the Pliocene, and that was a different planet. Sea level was about 25 meters higher, for example.
What do you say to people who say, okay, it was like that in the Pliocene and we weren't around in the Pliocene, so who done it? I mean, historically, the planet has always warmed or cooled. As it warms, carbon dioxide increases. That's one issue. The other thing is that we've always seen these fluctuations. How do you address those, according to the climate skeptics, flaws in your argument?
Well, in fact, they're not flaws. The history of the Earth actually is our best basis for understanding how sensitive the climate is to changes in atmospheric composition. Yes, the Earth's climate has changed enormously over its history. 50 million years ago, there was no ice on the planet, and sea level was 75 meters higher. The reason was that there was about 1,000 ppm CO2 compared to the 390 now.
But why was the CO2 so high then?
Because the natural source of CO2 is volcanoes that occur at the edges of continents as they move, a continental drift. As the continents subduct the ocean floor beneath the moving continent, the ocean floor, the carbonates on the ocean floor, by metamorphosis, it creates basalt and other rocks, and CO2 is emitted from volcanoes. And because 50 million years ago, India was moving across the Indian Ocean before it crashed into Asia and began to push up the Himalaya Mountains and the Tibetan Plateau, there were, at that time, it was moving across that ocean where the ocean floor was carbonate rich. So a lot of CO2 was put in the atmosphere.
There's no way that volcanic activity could explain the increase in CO2 right now.
No, it does affect the amount of CO2, but the magnitude of that source is about 10 to the minus 4, 1/10,000th of a ppm per year. So now humans are increasing CO2 2 ppm per year. Last year, 388. This year, 390. So we're 10,000 times more powerful than the volcanic source. Humans are now in control of future climate. In the past, it could change very slowly due to natural processes, but now humans have taken over. We just overwhelm that natural source.
But sea level changes, for example, of several meters have occurred before. Species have become extinct before.
Sure.
It's what happens. Regardless of who done it, it's always been what happens.
Right.
So why?
But it's the rate that counts. Species go extinct slowly and new ones will evolve. But if we, and there have been mass extinctions in the Earth's history, a few times there was global warming of 5 or 6 degrees Celsius, and it drove a large fraction of the species on the planet to extinction. And over hundreds of thousands and millions of years, new species evolved. But if we suddenly, this century, drive a significant fraction of species to extinction, we will be leaving a much more desolate planet for our children, grandchildren, and any timescale that we can imagine. The natural timescales are much longer. We can't wait 100,000 years for new species to evolve.
Mm. That's our problem, though, isn't it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's our problem.
It's our problem.
And at this point, you have to ask what's natural and what isn't.
Well, yes. That's part of the problem.
Yeah.
Because the weather fluctuations are natural. People see those. They don't notice this slow change. People who are old enough and are observant will notice that climate is changing. And we've only seen about half of the climate change due to the gases in the atmosphere already, because the ocean is 4 kilometers deep, so it doesn't quickly respond. That's part of the problem. There's more climate change in the pipeline.
Let us talk about the other point of argument that I mentioned a little earlier, that as the planet has warmed, carbon dioxide increases. How do you respond to the argument that it's not carbon dioxide causing the warming, it's vice versa?
You're referring to, and the skeptics will refer to the fact that in the glacial to interglacial oscillations, you know, 20,000 years ago we were in an ice age and the planet was 5 degrees Celsius colder. Those oscillations are driven, initiated by perturbations to the Earth's orbit and changes in the tilt of the Earth's spin axis relative to the plane of the Earth's orbit. So when the tilt of the spin axis is larger, that means there's more sunlight on the polar regions, and that will tend to melt the ice sheets at high latitude. And that will then make the planet warmer. The ocean gives up carbon dioxide the same way that your Pepsi does if it gets warmer. And that causes further temperature change. But it's the initial temperature change that caused the ocean to give up the CO2. So in that case, yes, the CO, the temperature changed first and the CO2 after it, because the drive for those glacial to interglacial climate changes are the perturbations of the Earth's orbit. And this is very well understood.
So what makes you so sure that it's not the sun changing the climate now?
Yeah, that's because we began to measure the sun in 1978 very precisely. And the great thing is that the last 6 years, the sun was in its deepest solar minimum in that period since 1978 to the present. And yet, during that 6 year period, the planet was gaining energy at a rate of 0.6 watts per meter squared. That's what we measure with these Argo floats all around the world's ocean. So this provided a proof positive that the human-made forcing dominates over the variations of the sun, which do exist, but they're only about 0.25 watts, while the human-made CO2 forcing is about 1.6 watts.
Did you have an epiphany about how serious you felt the situation is? In other words, you know, there are a series of steps. If one looks at your career, you started out looking more at space than Earth, and then you gave the congressional testimony in 1988, and then you changed from thinking that 450 ppm was tolerable to 350 being required. Did you have a moment where you thought, oh, my God?
Well, you know, it was a series of a couple of them, a few of them. I was a planetary scientist for the first decade of my career, and I proposed an experiment to go to the planet Venus to measure the clouds of Venus. Venus looked very interesting. There's this haze. You can't see through this veil that surrounds Venus. That experiment was accepted by NASA, and we were building the instrument when a postdoc from Harvard University asked me to help him make calculations for how trace gases like methane and nitrous oxide might affect the Earth's climate.
Yeah, we haven't even started talking about methane and nitrous oxide.
Yeah, but what we realized then, and we wrote a paper that was published in Science Journal, showing that these other gases, as well as CO2, would affect the Earth's temperature. And at that point, I realized this planet is much more interesting than a dead planet like Venus. And I resigned as the principal investigator on this mission while it was on its way to Venus, and my friend took that over, and I've been working on the Earth's climate since then. But I guess the other epiphany that's worth mentioning is the data that we began to get for the Earth's history, which shows us just how sensitive the Earth's climate is to changes in boundary conditions such as atmospheric composition. And sure, the planet could do fine with more CO2, but the problem is civilization developed during this current interglacial period, which is now almost 12,000 years long, which had a very stable climate and stable sea level. And the kind of changes that we're making to the atmosphere are going to send us to a climate state which is fundamentally very different than the one we're in, with a lot of consequences for humanity, but also for the other species on the planet, because we're changing the climate much faster than the natural ones that have occurred in the Earth's history.
How do you know that? Whatever we do, we are not already past the tipping point, as James Lovelock, I think, says, the feedback over which we have no control.
Well, there are...
Can you just not afford to think like that?
That's a very difficult problem. That there are different tipping points. One that I'm particularly concerned about is the stability of ice sheets on Greenland and Antarctica. Because once an ice sheet begins to disintegrate and slide down the slope toward the ocean, then it's too late. You've passed the tipping point. The dynamics will take over, and if you reduce the gases, it's not going to affect the ice sheet. They'll collapse. We're getting close to that. We now have this gravity satellite, which measures the Earth's gravitational field with such a high precision that we can measure the changes in the mass of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheet. And Greenland is losing mass now at a rate of more than 200 cubic kilometers per year. Antarctica almost as fast. So, but sea level is now going up 3 centimeters per decade. That's not negligible, but it's not disastrous yet, except for a few Pacific Island nations where there are going to be some refugees during the next few decades. But the danger is that those ice sheets will collapse. And we know from the Earth's history that when an ice sheet collapses, 14,000 years ago, sea level went up 5 meters a century for 4 centuries in a row, 20 meters of sea level rise. That was the ice sheet that covered Canada. Now we've got 2 ice sheets left, Greenland and Antarctica, and we don't want one of them to collapse.
I described you a little earlier as a scientist who has become increasingly radical. Do you disagree with that description?
Oh, I'm very mild-mannered. I'm not.
Well, not all scientists, for example, get arrested when they're protesting against a coal mine.
Yeah, well, I was protesting against mountaintop removal. It's a very environmentally damaging. It really destroys a mountain, lowers the top by 400 meters just to get at a seam of coal that's a few meters thick.
But what were you worried about, the coal releasing carbon dioxide or the loss of a mountaintop?
Well, it's both. I'm really worried about the climate. But
yes.
Then when I gave a talk at Virginia Tech University, the students showed me what was happening on the nearby mountains, and it really is pretty awful. So, and it makes no sense. If we burn all the coal, we're going to have to figure out some way to get that CO2 out of the atmosphere.
It's not every scientist who describes trains bearing coal as death trains, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, your language, it's fair to say, has become increasingly heated.
Yeah, I'm trying to illustrate fundamental facts. If we burn all of the coal, we're going to drive a large fraction of the species on the planet to extinction. So those coal trains might as well be carrying those species to their extermination.
Coal-fired power plants, you say, are factories of death.
Exactly.
So when New Zealand talks about reopening coal mines or continuing coal mining, you say what?
It's a huge mistake. We're all on the same boat together.
Yeah, but if we don't do it, somebody else will. That's the argument, isn't it?
That's right. And the way that we could fix the problem is really quite simple. We have to put a price on carbon emissions, collect a fee from the fossil fuel companies at the first sale, at the mine or the port of entry. And if that fee were gradually increasing over time, that would cause people to begin to change their habits, make the lifestyle changes to use less fossil fuels. And the way that the public would accept that is if 100% of the money that was collected from the fossil fuel companies were distributed to the public on a per capita basis. So the person who did better than average in using less than average fossil fuels, they would get more money in this dividend than they would pay in increased energy prices.
Oh, look, I'll just set up a committee and work out who gets what and when and by how. I mean, that sounds like a nightmare.
No, on the contrary, it's incredibly simple.
Is it? Everybody
gets the same amount. Just divide the total amount that's collected from the fossil fuel company by the number of legal residents and give them monthly an electronic distribution.
No, but it's not only fossil fuel companies that would come into it. I mean, we have an argument here over the agricultural industry. Now, the agricultural industry is lobbying to be left out of our emissions trading scheme altogether, and they've certainly got a big delay on their involvement in it. It's not just fossil fuels. We're worried about, we mentioned methane and nitrous oxide earlier.
Well, fossil fuels are most of the problem, and this fee should be across the board on the coal, oil and gas, the fossil fuels. There is some potential value in reducing some other trace gases, including methane, and we should have some ways of rewarding those farmers and people who are able to reduce those emissions. But what I'm talking about is the CO2 that comes from coal, oil, and gas. That's 90% of the increasing greenhouse gas forcing. So that, and it's the thing that has to be stopped quickly, because the CO2 stays in the atmosphere for millennia. Methane has a lifetime of only 10 to 12 years, so it's not as urgent a problem. It's really the coal which is the big issue. Oil and gas, there's not as much, and we're going to use the easily available oil and gas. They're owned by Saudi Arabia and Russia. It's going to be used, but the coal is the dirtiest. It produces more CO2 than any of the other fossil fuels, but we should have an across-the-board fee on carbon with the money distributed to the public, and it's very simple. You just divide long division, divide by the number of legal residents and give them an equal share, and those who do have a less, smaller carbon footprint will actually get more in the dividend than they pay in increased energy prices.
The New Zealand argument, or the individual countries argument, would be that if we did something like this, then industry, jobs, investment would merely go to somewhere where there isn't such an impost. And consequently, unless the whole world does it simultaneously, there's no point in doing it at all.
Well, we're all in the boat together, and we're all going to have to do something. But in fact, it does have to be global. But that's the great thing about a carbon price or a carbon tax, because that can be made global, while emission trading scheme cannot be made global. There's no way that China or India will accept a cap on their economy. But they will, and in fact China is now considering a carbon tax, because they do not want to go down the path of the United States and become addicted to fossil fuels and have to protect supply lines from now into the future.
So cap and trade systems will not work.
They will not work.
Because why exactly?
Well, because they're jury-rigged by a fossil fuel industry and banks. There's no reason to bring banks into this. We need a very simple system across the board that covers all the fossil fuels. And principally, as I said, a cap and trade system will never be accepted by countries like China and India, because they are not the ones who have produced the excess CO2 in the atmosphere now. They're now the biggest contributors, but because of the long lifetime of CO2, most of the CO2 in the atmosphere today, the excess CO2, is produced by developed countries. And so they feel it's their, they have the right to produce their equivalent amount of CO2. However, they do realize that they will suffer from climate change more than most countries. China has 300 million people living near sea level. They also have very polluted atmosphere and water, so they would like to phase off these fossil fuels. The fossil fuels are finite. They're not going to last forever anyhow. So why don't we move to clean energies and energy efficiency now and save the planet for young people and future generations? And by the way, that's the big issue here. It's the intergenerational injustice. The current generation is burning the fossil fuels. The climate change will be felt mainly by young people and their children. So we really have to understand that, and we can't pretend that we don't understand it. Our parents did not know. They did not know they were creating a problem for the future. We cannot say that. We can only pretend that we do not know.
The trouble that you face is what's been described as the widening gap between scientific necessity and political possibility.
Yeah, and political possibility, that's because of the power of the fossil fuel industry. If a political leader would stand up and tell the truth and say, we need to put a price on carbon, and we're going to give the money to you, the public, not to the fossil fuel industry, the public could understand that. They would see that there are many advantages for energy security and national security, as well as preserving the climate.
Let me put it to you, though, that the fossil fuel industry only has power because there are uncertainties that it can rely on. You do accept that there are uncertainties.
Oh, the science has become very clear. What they're relying on is their ability to influence the public discussion. It's really an unfair discussion.
Well, I mean, here's what Professor James Franklin recently wrote in a book called What Science Knows and How It Knows It. He said there are uncertainties both in establishing that carbon dioxide is the main cause of warming and that the rise in carbon dioxide is mainly caused by burning fossil fuels. Some of the major uncertainties are water vapor multipliers, cloud formations, soil carbon, aerosols, and paleoclimate. Now, is he wrong in your book?
Some of those are not completely wrong. Most of them are wrong. I mean, the water vapor thing, the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere is determined by the temperature of the atmosphere. As the planet gets warmer, it holds more water vapor, and that amplifies the climate change. So we understand that very well. The atmospheric aerosols, the pollution, the particulate pollution, it's true, we're not measuring that as accurately as we should. The satellite that was going to do that, unfortunately, ended up in Southern Ocean. But nevertheless, we know that the greenhouse gases are dominating over the aerosols because we're measuring the planet's energy balance very accurately. And that shows us that there is more energy coming in than going out because of this heat trapping by the greenhouse gases. So sure, there's a lot of in different pieces of the science, there are uncertainties, but overall, the understanding is very good. And if you ask any authoritative scientific body like National Academies of Science, they will tell you that the basic science is very well understood, and humans now overwhelm the natural changes of forcings.
Let's go on to the further uncertainty mentioned by Professor Franklin then. He says there is uncertainty about whether any achievable policies will make much difference. Reducing carbon emissions is a very difficult and expensive way to keep temperature down. Well, if the climate skeptics are right, there will be no effect. If the climate scientists are right, very little.
Unfortunately, what we see is that if we stay on the path we're on, within a few decades, we will have no ice left in the Arctic, and we will have initiated changes on the ice sheets that will assure that our children and grandchildren will have continuing sea level changes that are out of their control. We will also destroy a significant fraction of the species on the planet. That's become very clear. The claim that it is expensive to do something about it is really that it will harm the economy, I think, is bogus. In fact, if we put a price on carbon and the business community knows that that's going to continue to rise, it will cause the movement, innovations and movement toward clean energies and energy efficiency, which will be very stimulative to the economy and create many new jobs in industries that will provide better jobs than mining coal.
There'll be a great disruption in between times, though, won't there?
I wouldn't call it a disruption. I would call it an economic stimulus. I think, sure, if you're a coal miner and that's the only thing you know how to do, then it is a disruption to your life. But the government should have some responsibility to help retrain people who are in industries which are not helpful.
This is a criticism that other scientists have made of you, though, going back to this issue of political possibility and scientific necessity. You don't have a realistic view of what is politically possible.
What is politically possible? We shouldn't underestimate our ability. I was a little disappointed.
Well, why not?
Because
the evidence so far, according to you, is not good.
Well, so far, money talks in capitals, in Washington and other capitals. If President Obama, when he took office, had explained for the good of our energy security and national security and climate, we're going to need to put a rising price on carbon, and the money will be distributed to the public. He could have, that would have worked.
He would have got that through Congress.
The problem is that he left the problem to Senator Kerry and Senator Boxer and the usual political process, and they then try to bargain with the fossil fuel industry, and they end up with this ridiculous...
But he would always have had to do that.
No, you don't have to do it that way. If you can go to the public, and you can explain what's necessary, and the public knows about lobbyists and the way things work, and I think they would appreciate a populist president who would look after the public's good rather than the fossil fuel industry and the lobbyists' good.
Do you think?
I think it's
possible.
I mean,
do you think or do you hope?
Well, I know that it's possible. We just need some politician who will stand up and be the Winston Churchill. It has to recognize that this is the moral issue of the 21st century. It's comparable in its importance to slavery or Nazism of the past century. We need a president who recognizes the importance of this and decides he's going to take the risks that go with standing up against that kind of power that the fossil fuel industry has.
Is economic growth in the long term, I'm not arguing with you when you say that there doesn't have to be an economic downturn if policies were implemented to try to avert climate change, but in general terms, is economic growth incompatible with ongoing action on climate?
Well, on climate, it's not incompatible with climate because we could find energy sources that do not produce greenhouse gases, and we could have better energy efficiency.
Well, I don't know. There's a report, there are a number of zero carbon reports, and a recent report called Zero Carbon Britain, for example, by 2030. It requires, what does it require? It requires electrification of the transport system, no domestic flights, reduction in livestock. I mean, theoretically, that could be done. It involves 130,000 offshore wind turbines.
Well, that was somebody's particular scheme.
But in order to be zero, do you think we should all be aiming to be zero carbon?
We don't have to go to zero carbon. But we do have to go to much lower carbon. And on the long run, it has to be pretty close to zero, but not immediately. This will have to be done over a
period of decades.
Well,
this wasn't immediate. I mean, this was 2030, zero carbon Britain.
Yeah, that's...
You know, we've
got
wind turbines covering the
area
of Wales.
I don't think that's practical. You know, there are some lawsuits that have been filed in the last... a week against the United States federal government and several states, and there will be some in other countries, in which it is requested that the courts tell the government to give them a plan to reduce their emissions at a rate that would stabilize climate this century. And that requires rapid reductions, but they would not go to zero by 2030. By 2050, they would be down to a small fraction of what they are now. But you can't, I don't think in 20 years you can go to zero carbon emissions, but you don't have to. You need about 5% per year reduction. That's a lot, but it's not zero. It's not taking it to zero in 2030. Mm.
You see, it's not only the current uncertainties, which you have dealt with, but other people still insist exist. It's the future uncertainties. I mean, for example, the Stern report in 2006, again in Britain. Stern said stabilizing temperatures at a warming of no more than 3 degrees Celsius would be the best we can hope for. He said keeping levels to 450 parts per million was already out of reach. And this is 5 years ago.
Well, what he's doing is trying to tell you what he thinks is politically possible. What I'm saying is what the science says is necessary if we want to avoid irreversible, substantial damage to the planet and the future of young people. And frankly, I think he's misestimating what is possible. If we once get people to realize that the clean energy future is actually a brighter future than the dirty going after the last bit of coal and going to the deepest ocean to get the last drops of oil, it actually makes more sense to move on to the clean energies of the future. And to do that promptly, you need to have the economic incentive provided by a gradually increasing carbon fee on coal, oil, and gas.
Do you regard nuclear energy as a clean energy?
As far as climate effect, yes. It does not affect the climate. A country like New Zealand doesn't need it. You're blessed with enormous potential of renewable energies. But
well,
countries like China and India...
Let's just halt on New Zealand for a moment. Yes, we have hydropower. Yes, we have wind power. Yes, we have solar power. But there is huge
geothermal.
Geothermal. There's huge opposition to damming more rivers. There's huge opposition to wind turbines.
Mm-hmm.
How do you overcome that opposition?
Well, you have to allow people to object to different forms. And if you... if you put a price on carbon, the decisions will have to be made. What is the most acceptable form of energy? And energy efficiency should be a big part of that. And that you will have pressure in that direction if you put a price on carbon.
What do you say to people who object to, for example, wind turbines on countryside that they regard as environmentally valuable and iconic?
Well, they certainly have that right. And
they have the right to object.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the different forms of energy, most of them do have some disadvantages. So that's in a democratic system, you allow people to make the objections, and then you have to decide which ones you're going to use.
Well, you're saying it's an issue of the death or life of the planet.
Yeah, and you know, frankly...
So it seems that people objecting to their view being disrupted are being a little fatuous, would you not say?
Pardon, I didn't understand that question.
Would you not say that people objecting to wind turbines on the grounds that they're destroying their view should just get over it, actually?
Well, I think, in my opinion, the windmills actually are attractive, but it is a matter of opinion. As I say, there are different choices you'll have to make, and even although I don't think nuclear needs to be used in New Zealand, it is certainly it's received a lot of criticism, which is not very rational. The fact is that fossil fuels are killing more than 1 million people per year from the air and water pollution. But people just accept that. And yet they're scared to death of radiation, even though the biggest accident in the United States, Three Mile Island, did not kill anybody. It did expose Pennsylvania residents to radiation. And the studies by the National Academy of Science say that perhaps one or two people will die early in Pennsylvania because of that. But the same population will have 40,000 people die from cancer due to other causes. So it's kind of irrational. But, of course, people have the choice. If they don't want nuclear, that's fine. But then there are disadvantages to wind. There are disadvantages to solar. You have to choose what energy you want if you want to have energy.
Your conviction that global climate change is a clear and present danger. Do you...
It's not just my conviction.
No.
The scientific community, really, if you ask any of the major...
Well, to be fair, though, you are a little bit further out than most of the scientific community, are you not?
Well, you know, these last papers, the one about 350 parts per million being the goal, I have 10 or 12 of the best scientists in the world as co-authors. And I was surprised at meetings like the American Geophysical Union, how widespread the acceptance was. Even though this was rather new, the evidence has become so clear that the climate already is changing and the planet is out of energy balance, which implies there's more in the pipeline.
Putting the certainties or uncertainties aside for a moment, do you worry that what you feel is the urgency of the situation has led you to abandon what one might think is the scientifically measured position?
No, I haven't abandoned the scientific position, but I have tried to make clear what the implications of the science are for the public, and especially for young people. I think young people really need to understand that there is potentially a huge injustice here if we allow these changes to continue without recognizing the impact that it's going to have on their future.
What about technological fixes? I mean, beyond wind farm, beyond solar power, sequestration of carbon?
That's carbon capture and sequestration, so-called clean coal, as
yes.
sometimes described, is really just a way, so far it's been just a way to allow them to continue to have dirty coal.
And well, you know, this might be the political probability rather than the political impossibility. Don't ban it.
Yeah.
Allow them to carry on and ameliorate it.
Yeah, but then they have to do it. So you'd have to say, well, if you're going to build a new coal plant, then include this carbon capture and sequestration. And the problem is that will make the coal so expensive that other energies would be cheaper. So
well, that
fact,
would be what
just,
you want.
Yeah, that's right. So we should put that requirement on. That would stop the coal.
All right. So carbon sequestration is a way not of enabling coal, but you're saying effectively stopping it.
Yeah, carbon capture might actually be useful. It may be that within several years, the government's going to realize, uh-oh, we've gone too far. We've got to get some of that CO2 out of the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Then what you could do is burn biofuels in a power plant, capture and sequester the CO2, and you would, in that way, lower the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. But that's going to take time and probably be expensive.
So is that the main way to mop up CO2 out of the air?
Yeah, but it's much cheaper and more sensible not to put it there.
Because biofuels are a whole other thing, of course. I mean, biofuels are causing forest destruction, for starters, aren't they?
Biofuels need to be done carefully.
Yeah.
You don't just – there's some that have potential, but you don't want to do it like in the United States where they have corn-based ethanol. They've driven up the cost of food, and they're not even reducing the CO2. They use so much fertilizer in growing this corn that they're producing just as much CO2.
Mm.
So it's just a crazy system.
New Zealand, of course, 50% by 2050 is our mantra emissions reduction target. From what you've said...
And in fact, your emissions have gone up 25%. So I'm afraid, I'm sorry to say, but New Zealand is just like a lot of other countries. They say the right words, but in fact, they're continuing basically business as usual.
So essentially you're saying that it's worse than doing nothing because it's pretending to do something?
Yeah.
Oh.
That's right.
So what we're doing is worse than nothing.
Yeah. What you need to do, we need... And New Zealand has such great potential. it could become carbon neutral, but it's not going to happen unless you put a price on carbon emissions.
Look, New Zealand is so dependent on exports that anything that makes our exports more expensive will be intolerable politically.
Well, yes, so you do need to do it globally. However, it
but
is actually...
But that's not going to happen. I mean, I understand what you're saying. We need to do it globally. Everybody needs to hold hands and do it simultaneously, like you saving know, Tinkerbell's life. But it's not going to happen, is it?
Well, I think it will happen. It absolutely will happen, or else our civilization is going to go down the drain. But it actually, there's some advantage in being out in front. That's why China is now investing so heavily in solar, wind, and nuclear power, because they know that the future has got to go that way, and they want to be out in front and have the technology ready to sell to the rest of the world. To have a modest carbon price is it set up a system which works so that the money that's collected is given to the public would actually make sense. You can't crank it up to a large amount until the rest of the world is willing to do the same thing. But I think that's going to happen. All it requires is, say, China and Europe, or China and the U.S., but the U.S. seems to be the laggard, but to agree that there's going to be a carbon price. And then they're allowed by the WTO rules to put a border duty on products from countries that do not have a carbon tax. And that would force the countries that don't have a carbon tax to quickly apply one. Otherwise, that way, if they do apply it, they can collect the money themselves. If they don't, it will be collected by the countries that do have it at their borders. So there is a way, there is a route to solving the problem, but it does require putting a price on carbon.
Mm. Suffice it to say that so far you have been disappointed by governments, apart from China, it seems.
Yeah, and China hasn't made the move yet, but they are thinking about having an internal carbon price. And if they did that, that I think would be a big step in pushing the rest of the world.
Essentially, we've just got too many people.
Well, you mean the world does?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
China is actually doing a good job of controlling their population. But yes, that is a problem. We have to admit that we can't continue to have the population get larger and larger. There are limits to how many people this planet can support.
It's very nice talking to you. I don't know, you seem to oscillate between optimism and pessimism. Is this the scientific balance?
Well, I think it's realistic. We have to be a little concerned that governments have been able to avoid facing the truth for a long time. But I think we have to try to be optimistic for the sake of our children and grandchildren.
Dr. James Hansen, who is director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York and adjunct professor at Columbia University's Earth Institute. He's here in New Zealand to give a public lecture, Climate Change, a Scientific, Moral and Legal Issue.